Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke. This is the July 8th, 2012 edition of Space Talk live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this beautiful Sunday afternoon as we spend the next hour together talking about our nation's space program and as we continue to celebrate the 50th anniversary of our Kennedy Space Center. We began last week with the help of three longtime Space Center veterans, George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp. They shared some great memories of what it was like to work out at KSC during the early days of Apollo and the space shuttle. Next week, we're going to focus on the future of the Kennedy Space Center with the help of our current center director, former NASA astronaut, and a Minnesota native, Bob Cabana. But today, we're going to hear some thoughts on what's happening in space right now and how recent missions by SpaceX to our International Space Station and by the Chinese to their own orbiting outpost may or may not be important to all of us on the Space Coast, and I'll bet they both are. We'll talk about all this and a whole lot more with our good friend, former NASA astronaut Tom Jones, who will be joining us by phone in just a few minutes. Plus, you can join the conversation as well. If you have any questions or comments to share about our space program, feel free to give us a call, 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And if you're more comfortable sending us an email, the address is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, let's get started with today's edition of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. With the Independence Day holiday behind us and this being a presidential election year, we can expect to hear an increasing amount of campaign rhetoric from both Democrats and Republicans as we get closer to the big day in November. To what extent our space program will be a topic in the national debate remains to be seen, of course. So far, I haven't been much impressed with what either side has been saying, which hasn't been much. Of course, we remember back to candidate Barack Obama originally wanting to put the space program on hold for 5 years and give all the money to education, and then he came to the Space Coast and promised a robust space program that would keep every space shuttle worker employed, and we all saw how that turned out. More recently, we've seen candidate Mitt Romney and more than a few late-night comedians ridicule Mitt's fellow Republican Newt Gingrich for suggesting this nation try doing something bold and innovative by establishing a permanent base on the moon. Romney famously said he would fire anyone who came to him with such a plan that would cost billions of dollars, and then he said his plan for NASA as president would be to gather experts to conduct a study of what NASA should be doing. As if that's what we need. Yet another study to tell us what so many previous expert panels have told us before. So as the campaign continues, we in the space community, I think, need to look for every opportunity to question our candidates about their plans for NASA and our space program in general. And I'm not just talking about the run for the White House. Our elected leaders in the United States House and Senate have as much to do with how we're spending our tax dollars and where, as does the president. Unfortunately, I don't hold out much hope it will make a difference. I'm afraid the candidates won't really pay attention or be willing to alter their views. I'm afraid that we in the space community also won't be speaking in large enough numbers or even agree on what it is that we really want in the first place. You know, sort of a recent example of this can be seen on the White House webpage that provides an opportunity for citizens to petition the president on any issue. If a certain threshold of signers is reached, then the White House promises a response. And that did happen recently when a petition was offered requesting that NASA's budget be doubled so that one penny of every tax dollar goes to the space agency. Now, only 27,334 people among the millions of alleged space fans that are out there signed it. would hope there would be a lot more people out there willing to put their name on such a petition. But, you know, if you didn't know about it, what can you do? So in any case, it did hit the threshold. The official White House response came, and it was illuminating, to say the least. Their response essentially boiled down to this. It said, thanks for calling. We think you're really neat people, and we love NASA too, but we're not going to give you what you asked for. And, oh yeah, Republicans are mean. The response gives the president all sorts of credit for what NASA is doing now, some of which was, in fact, begun by his predecessors. The president takes credit for a space policy that a lot of people still question for its lack of clear goals, timelines, and an appropriate budget to get it all done. And in what admittedly is, I think, a clever sleight of hand in terms of the writing, the White House says that while they can't double NASA's budget, here, listen to this. This is from the response. Quote, NASA and space are so important to our future that we do need to be doubling and tripling what we can accomplish in this domain. That's why the president's plan for NASA more than doubles the number of U.S. rockets capable of going to the ISS. So I guess the White House here is saying we're not doubling the budget, we're doubling what we can do. In fact, a quick fact check. We have three rockets right now that are capable of going to ISS, the Delta IV, Atlas V, and Falcon 9, but only the Falcon 9 has really made the trip or has plans to. With Orbital Sciences' Antares rocket coming soon, this will make a fourth rocket. So depending on how you do the count, you can say that we went from 2 to 4 rockets, or maybe 3 to 4, or maybe even 0 to 2. None of those numbers is more than double, as the White House claims. The petition response says, quote, and the James Webb Space Telescope, which the president's budget keeps on track for launch later this decade, won't just double Hubble's capabilities, but it will be 100 times more powerful, which, of course, is true. But that response of increasing the budget for the Webb Telescope remains controversial within the science community. Petition says, response says, this summer, Americans in a control room in California will be monitoring as an automobile-sized rover is lowered onto the Martian surface from a sky crane hovering in the rusty atmosphere of Mars. And which I kind of wonder, how can an atmosphere be rusty? I thought the Martian soil was rusty. But in any case, it says the Curiosity Mars rover isn't just double the size of any previous rover, but is also carrying 10 times the mass of scientific instruments as America's Opportunity rover currently operating on the surface. Well, that's all pretty much true. In terms of the budget, though, the White House goes out of its way to take what I think is an unnecessary and misleading shot at the Republicans, apparently unable to avoid a chance to campaign. The response said, unfortunately, not everyone is supportive of this ambitious effort. Rather than making bold, targeted investments in our space future and embarking on new partnerships with the private sector to ensure every taxpayer dollar is spent wisely, the proposed Republican House budget plan, if spread evenly, would significantly cut NASA's budget, forcing the deepest cuts to the space program since just after we landed on the moon. Well, this is the kind of rhetoric that just drives me crazy. Those three words, if spread evenly, is a big assumption and an even greater reach to accuse someone of not supporting our space program just because they don't agree with every aspect of your plan. I don't agree with every piece of the current national space policy, but does that make me not supportive of this ambitious effort? You could hardly find someone more supportive of space exploration than me. So I guess, according to the White House, we have enough to make do, and I guess I should feel like I'm sorry for asking more. But anyway, please understand. Now, I'm picking on this particular example from the White House, not to say that any one candidate for president is better than the other. Frankly, I'm not happy with either one for reasons that go way beyond just our national space policy. But what I am trying to say is that during the remaining months between now and Election Day, we have got to let these folks know what we're thinking and be active in the telling. We've got a pretty great space program now with lots of potential for some incredible things in the future, and we can do better. And so can the next occupants of the White House and Capitol Hill, whoever they might be. That's Orbital Inclinations for this week. Okay, we're taking a quick break. Back in just a moment with more, give us a call, 321-768-1240. Spacetalking@AOL.com is the email address. We'll be joined by former NASA astronaut Tom Jones after this short break. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, during my time as a space reporter for both Florida Today and Space.com, some of my most memorable shuttle missions included flights that my next guest was a crew member on. And among the reasons I think they were so memorable is that you could always count on astronaut Tom Jones for a great quote or a simple explanation for some complicated task they were performing in space. Tom flew on four shuttle missions between the time he was selected for astronaut training in 1990 and then when he retired from NASA in 2001. He spent 53 days in space, just a few minutes over that, in fact, flying aboard the shuttles Endeavour, Columbia, and Atlantis. He's the author of at least four books that I know of, including my favorite of his, Skywalking. And with that introduction, we welcome back to Space Talk Dr. Tom Jones, who joins us by phone from, Tom, I didn't even ask you where you were calling from. Where are you at today?
Hi, Jim. It's great to be with you, and I'm in Northern Virginia, where it's 100 degrees today.
Ooh, it's hot there. Well, it's a balmy 84 degrees right now here in Melbourne, Florida. So
fantastic. I'm due down there in September to soak up those cold temperatures.
Hey, and you're going to come down in September. I hope you're going to be here for our 50th anniversary gala that we're having at the Space Center September 22nd. I don't know if you heard about it yet, but we are in the 50th anniversary of the Space Center this week. As you know, last Sunday was the actual birthday. And, Tom, I was just curious to get started with you, if you could tell us and talk a little bit about some of your favorite memories about coming to Kennedy Space Center, maybe even beyond just coming here for a launch. You know, did you have any favorite occasions, things that you did, the experiences that you had out here?
Oh, my first visit there was an eye-popping memory for me because I had grown up in the 60s just being a space nut, and I was reading everything I could about space and following each mission religiously and you know, watching every minute of every moonwalk on television.
Yeah.
Even all of the Gemini missions I paid great attention to. And I still have scrapbooks full of clippings from all of the Gemini and Apollo flights. So my family took a vacation to Florida in 1970.
Yeah.
So in the summer of 1970, probably in July, we were down there for the better part of a week. And one of the pilgrimages we had to make was to the Space Center. So I was lucky enough to, you know, go to the Visitor Center back then and take the bus tour with my family. And we did the old Air Force Cape Canaveral side of the Space Center tour, and saw the early Mercury and Gemini pads, and then and also the Space Museum down there that the Air Force runs.
Right.
And then we did get a chance to go out to the Vehicle Assembly Building, and there was Apollo 14 being prepped for launch inside the VAB. And, of course, we took in all the sites of the launch pads and the Launch Control Center and so on. So it really was an amazing visit, and that really inspired me to redouble my efforts to try to find a path to get into the space program. I came back again in 1977 when I was an Air Force Academy cadet and took a field trip with my astronautics class down there. And that was in the hiatus between Apollo Soyuz and the space shuttle. So when I was there, things were very quiet, but there was still a lot of evidence of the Apollo training and operations, and in fact we saw some of the Apollo hardware that was still on display.
Yeah.
And then came back many years later. I don't think I made it back until I joined NASA in 1990, and it was a revelation.
You know, it's so funny that you say that, because I hadn't heard you tell that story about the visitor conference. I have almost the exact same story to share, only mine was in basically holiday time around, it must have been 1972, because we came down here from Minnesota. And took the same tour, went out. I never forget, we went out to the Air Force Space Missile Museum and drove by all the missiles. And it was the first time my dad ever let me actually operate his 35-millimeter camera, the really cool one that had the leather case. And which means that I have a great number of color slides of all these missiles, very fuzzy, out of focus, and out of frame.
That's
it was great, you know, for whatever I was, 10-year-old or whatever. And then we saw Apollo 16 on the pad. And again, I'll never forget how important that experience of the visitor complex was for inspiring a kid to follow through on a dream. And of course, yours to space, what, four flights, some incredible experiences, and maybe we could just spend a little time reminiscing about those experiences. I'll never forget your Wake Shield flight, of course. I'll never forget any of them, but the Wake Shield, boy, what an incredible experiment that you were involved with and operating the robot arm and all that. And I kind of wonder whatever happened to that whole technology. And do you ever follow up on what happened all these years later?
I run into people who were on the Wake Shield project back in Houston from time to time, and I often ask the same questions. And so that satellite was weighed about 8,000 pounds, and it was looked a little like a flying saucer, about 14 feet across, and it was berthed in the back of the cargo bay of Columbia on that 1996 STS-80 flight. So yeah. It was a mini computer chip factory or a materials science experiment designed to lay down thin films of semiconductor material, atomic layer by atomic layer, with a laboratory bench setup. And the whole idea was that it would use the clean, empty vacuum of space to try to make pure high-performance semiconductor wafers, which would then be tested back on the ground in the lab for their performance characteristics. And the idea was that maybe one day we could manufacture these high-performance semiconductors, the basis of computer chips, sure, in space as part of an electronics industry that might be established at a space station, for example, or an industrial facility of some sort. So the Wake Shield went out for 3 days, and I was the arm operator to release it and to grapple it back aboard. And we had a very successful mission with the Wake Shield. It was a free flyer that would be controlled from the ground and fly about 30 miles behind the shuttle to get away from all the contamination that the shuttle emits.
Sure.
And one of my spectacular memories is when we released the Wake Shield, it had a very low-powered cold gas nitrogen thruster that would propel it slowly away from Columbia and then make it take up its station-keeping position. And this thing crawled away from the shuttle. And as we orbited the Earth and the Wake Shield slowly departed, because of orbital mechanics, the two orbits of this spacecraft and Columbia almost intersected. So this Wake Shield flew over our cabin windows at a range of about 2 feet.
Oh, no.
And, we were so reluctant to fire the thrusters to move away from it because that would contaminate the spacecraft, and we'd probably have to re-grapple it, clean it out with an exposure to the atomic oxygen flow in space, and then repeat the whole process again. So rather than waste all that time, we just sort of gritted our teeth and kept the ship in free drift. And boy, it missed us by about 2 feet.
Missed
it by curve feelers to get by it.
Missed it by that much. So
that's right.
You know, I remember doing the pre-flight briefings as a news media back then, and I think it was second only to the whole tethered satellite experiment in its complexity to understand. Not so much the mechanics. It was pretty easy. You set this thing out. It's got a shield, basically, you know, pushing away what little stuff is in space to leave this pure vacuum behind it. But to understand the physics and just how the whole, you know, atomic layer by layer thing would work, and man, it was a great mission.
It did do its job, and it was retrieved by the shuttle, of course, and we brought it back. It went back to Houston, to the University of Houston, and I believe the spacecraft is still largely intact in some sort of a storage facility in Houston.
Maybe someday it'll go up again and we'll put it on a commercial flight or something.
I think they had been holding out that hope for quite a while.
Yeah.
I don't know what the plans for it are now, but it certainly would make a great display somewhere, or, as you say, it could be cannibalized and flown again or refurbished and flown again.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but it's one of those deals where you better call Elon Musk and see if he knows about it.
That's right.
You know, hey, your space radar laboratory, why don't you talk a little bit about that too, because you got to fly that experiment twice, that device twice, once as basically, I don't know how to say it, as a mission specialist, of course,
right,
but then the second time as really the payload commander, is the guy in charge of the thing. You know, what was that like for you in terms of how that operated both, and what was that experience of being a payload commander in those days?
Well, this was my first shuttle flight in 1994, and so I was very excited to finally experience this thing I'd been dreaming about since I made that trip with my family to the Cape and even before then. So I was really charged up, and I was the only rookie on board the flight. And so we were about perhaps 3 or 4 months from launch, and I was just deep in the preparations for this mission to planet Earth. And I got called down to the corner office in the astronaut floor in Building 4 North in Houston. And, Hoot Gibson was the boss at that
really?
Point.
Okay.
And he called me in and he said, you know, how are things going for the flight preparations? And I said, oh, great, I'm so excited, I can't wait to go. And he said, well, I have another job for you, and they want to fly the radar again, as I knew they would.
Right.
And he said, you're the only person from the first crew that is available, and Jet Propulsion Lab wants to have a crew member bring over the corporate knowledge from the first mission to the second. So how would you like to be the payload commander on the second trip?
Wow.
So he's asking me for this job when I haven't even flown my first trip. So I thought he was making a pretty big bet that I was going to work out okay in space. I thought that was a nice vote of confidence.
A little job security there, too. That must have been thrilling to know that you're going to go up once and then already know you got your second seat.
Yes, and while I was in space on STS-59, I got an email message from my second crew saying, hope you're having a good time. Simulator sessions start when you get back. So they were really ribbing me.
They couldn't wait.
I was behind in my training with their crew.
That was
a really rewarding mission as a planetary scientist to take a remote sensing instrument, state-of-the-art digital radar, three wavelengths so we could examine the Earth in a multispectral fashion. And we did almost every Earth science experiment or examination you can think of, geology, biology, agriculture, ocean pollution,
right,
tectonics, and so forth. And while we were operating the radar in space for 11 days on each time, we had to operate the ship and its systems from underneath the windows of the payload of the flight deck cabin.
And Tom, stand by right there. We're going to cut you off, and we'll finish the story when we pick up. We're going to take a quick break. Our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour here. Get caught up on news, weather, and sports. We'll be back with Tom Jones in just a minute. I'm Jim Behnke. You are listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions and comments. The phone number is 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. On the phone from Virginia today, a good friend and favorite guest here on Space Talk, Dr. Tom Jones, former NASA astronaut. And, Tom, we were talking about some of your shuttle missions. I want to finish up the talk about the Space Radar Laboratory because it was a great mission and saw all sorts of interesting things and a lot of follow-up on the data I've seen over the years since. Can you just finish up that story about how great SRL was?
Well, sure. Space Radar Lab put me to work right underneath the flight deck window, so I was forced to stare at the Earth every day for each of my 11
darn
days
the luck.
Space from 120 miles up. So we had a high-inclination orbit, covered most of the planet, and then we were low altitude, about half as high as most shuttle missions. So we really had a great view of planet Earth. And the radar was applied on a third mission. I didn't get to fly that one, but its capability of mapping the terrain below was part of the Space Radar Topography mission in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And that radar map, generated by the same hardware that we flew on the first two flights, created a digital terrain map of the entire globe. And that digital map is now in aircraft cockpits. It's in all of the military aircraft serving over in the Middle East. And it also is even man-carried. You could put it in a laptop. And so if you're in the mountains of Afghanistan, you know exactly what the terrain is based on the space shuttle's radar map.
Now, and forgive me if I'm mixing up some missions here, but didn't SRL do some work where it found things below the surface? Either?
Yes, in very dry terrains like the deserts. The radar's longest wavelength at L-band, about 23 centimeters in wavelength, could penetrate down several meters into the soil, hit the bedrock, and bounce back. So in the Sahara, we could map drainages, rivers that used to flow beneath the sands of the Sahara, telling us about the ancient climate and the drainage pattern there. We found a lot of, in fact, 200,000-year-old human artifacts from the early humans that lived in the area. And then over in the Arabian Peninsula, the shuttle helped confirm the location of the lost city of Ubar, which was a caravan trading stop in the incense and frankincense trade back 2,000 years ago. So the caravan trails, now buried by sand, were visible to the radar imagery.
I think that's so neat about spaceflight. You know, we go up, look out, look back, and learn whichever way we seem to be pointing our eyes and our devices. I mean, that's great.
Yeah, a little bit of Indiana Jones there.
Yeah, really. Hey, I want to start talking about some of the current events here, and I don't want to start on a bad note, but I did get an email from Bob in Port St. John. Wanted to know if you had worked with Alan Poindexter. We lost Dex last Sunday in an accident.
Indeed. Dex's death is a real tragedy and a loss, not only to his family, but to the entire NASA astronaut corps. And he served for almost a decade in the astronaut corps, and he was overlapped 3 years with me in Houston while I was helping prepare for my flight to the space station. And then Dex, of course, on his two missions, went to the space station and commanded the shuttle on his last mission. So he was a very accomplished astronaut, a very solid colleague, professional in every way, and a great family guy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's really a great loss for his family. And we grieve with them. And, you know, I'm up here in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm sure that I'll have the sad duty to go to his internment at Arlington, but
sure.
It'll be a great honor to do that.
Sure. Hey, now, you know, a lot of things have been happening in space, and I know that part of what you do is you're out and about in the public and talking about space, and I'm curious about what the interest is. But with things happening like SpaceX's trip to the International Space Station and things happening like Chinese, their flight to their little mini lab up in space as well and the advancements they're making, what are you thinking about these things right now in terms of commercial space and international, I don't know if it's competition, but international activity? And what is the public asking you about as you go about in your travels?
Let's start with the last question first. I frequently get asked at book signings or speeches that what is my reaction to the fact that the space program is over? That's what people ask me.
Yeah, right.
So their perception is that with the shuttle's retirement a year ago that we have no space program. And it's certainly true that we are in a hiatus in terms of human spaceflight launches from the U.S. So Cape Canaveral isn't going to see astronauts launch for about another 5 years. And I think that's a terrible, terrible embarrassment for the nation when the Russians and the Chinese are flying in space, and we can't do that ourselves. We do have, of course, Americans in space 24/7 at the International Space Station. My friend Don Pettit just came back, and Sunita Williams is headed up there to the space station in a few weeks, and what Joe Acaba is up there right now with the rest of the six-man crew. So we do have a human spaceflight program. It's making good use of the facilities that I helped build at the International Space Station and that Dex Poindexter did as well. And we should make maximum use of that in terms of planning for the next generation of spaceflight. So we ought to be planning to test advanced life support, new spacesuits, even some free-flying inspection vehicles for crew members to fly around the space station and do maintenance, but also be applied to later visits to deep space, the asteroids, and Phobos and Deimos, for example.
Right.
So we can make great use of the space station as an exploration lab in the next 10 years. And then we really ought to be accelerating our efforts to get the commercial transport to the station on duty, on deck, and also our deep space capability needs to fly faster and more frequently than is currently planned by NASA. And that's all a budget challenge. And so we do need to increase the NASA budget to accelerate both of those parallel human spaceflight efforts.
Right. Hey, you know, a lot of very specific things to ask you about in all of that. The one thing I'm wondering, as much as the space station is great for an exploration platform, there's a lot of talk lately, certainly around here in Florida, about the commercial science aspects of it and finding work to do there. CASIS as an organization has been in the news a lot. This is the organization based here in Florida that's supposed to manage the space station,
right,
as a national lab, as a U.S. national lab. You know, your experience with all of this kind of activity, we mentioned Wake Shield. You were up there when Destiny was installed, and so you know that part of the space station rather intimately. Is there more work to be done? Is it the right environment? Do you think there's something we can find up there that does make commercial sense?
Well, without question, the space station has the capacity and the utilities, the power and the communications, for example, to host commercial experiments. And that ought to be an effort that NASA really accelerates, is seeking out commercial sponsors and vendors and experimenters to the space station. And perhaps that means flying up personnel from commercial companies to spend a few weeks at the space station in between crew rotations, sort of like the old payload specialist concept on the space shuttle.
Sure.
We ought to do everything we can to make maximum use of the facilities up there so that we're getting the maximum return on our investment in the space station. And, you know, with the launch prices hopefully coming down from SpaceX and other companies, it may be cheaper now to get experiments up there and operate them and then bring back the samples with, you know, reusable spacecraft like the Dragon. So I'm hopeful that NASA will take advantage of that opportunity. And Bill Gerstenmaier, who's head of human spaceflight and operations down at NASA headquarters, I think he's certainly very interested in opening up that dimension of the space station.
You know, as an astronaut and as a guy who knows other astronauts, both in the pilot world and the science world, there's been a lot of different reactions to this idea of commercial crew. That program here, of course, based at Kennedy now. whether it's safe, whether it's right, whether it should be something we're doing. And you hear different things. I hear everything from some old-timers that just still can't get along with it. Even the commercial cargo to the space station. I hear other guys are all for it. And I hear guys that said they were against it, but now are suddenly for it as they learn more. Where do you fall on the spectrum, and what do you have to say about commercial crew and all of that?
Well, commercial cargo is fundamental, and I was on the NASA Advisory Council 4 or 5 years ago when that program got started, and I'm very much a big backer of NASA getting commercial help for the cargo shipments that we need, and it looks like we're on the right track to get that train going. We might be a couple of years late, but I think the fact that we can then do away with the Russian progress payments and get our own domestic cargo shipments up there is a fantastic development.
Sure.
And I hope that Orbital will be just as much.
And Tommy, still there? Okay,
yes.
You dropped out there for a second. But, so you hope that Orbital will get going and we can stop doing progress.
Exactly, and I hope Orbital will have as much success in their flights this fall as Dragon has had so far on Falcon 9. And then in terms of crew transport, I do think it's going to take too long for my comfort level to wait another 5 years to get commercial transports underway. That's the latest NASA estimate. Right. So I really think we need to have more resources devoted to accelerating that program. I'm not in favor of NASA trying to reinvent the wheel with its own government-owned transport at this point. You know, we are where we are today in July of 2012. We should accelerate the commercial efforts, and that might take more budget authority than NASA has right now. So if we have an electoral change in the fall, that would be one thing I would expect the new administration to do, is to accelerate that commercial transport. It's not good for national security to not have access to our own space station that we largely built and paid for ourselves,
right,
except through the Russians. And I think to risk the life and health of the space station because we don't have our own access, and we have only one way of getting there now through Russia, is a national security risk, and we ought to rectify that.
So looking ahead then, and you know, we don't want to build our own new rockets again, and Tom, with about a minute left before our next break, what do you think about the SLS, the Space Launch System, the new heavy lift vehicle? Do we need a vehicle like that, or can we get by with multiple Delta IVs and assemble something in orbit?
I think you can do either. I think it's more operationally complex to rendezvous and refuel multiple spacecraft in low Earth orbit using existing heavy launchers. So that's going to be an operational challenge, and that could be more expensive in the long run than having a heavy lifter. We may be able to fly the Space Launch System, the big heavy booster, in its initial version, and package everything that we need to do in deep space on that rocket so we don't have to go to the larger 130-ton vehicle down the road. So I would think that we should look very carefully at what combination of Space Launch System and existing commercial launchers can get us to the point where we need to, where we can accomplish things in Earth-Moon space. That means, you know, orbiting the Moon, going to the Lagrange points, maybe even putting together an asteroid expedition without having to go to a full-blown SLS.
Okay, Tom, hey, stand by. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we'll ask Tom Jones about China and maybe some other little things here along the way. Hey, plus we'll take a look at our local launch forecast. I'm Jim Banky. You are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with a reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. If you're on Twitter, look for Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping about the program, just visit www.wmmbam.com, keywords Space Talk. As we continue along with our program, let's take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. Our next space shot from Cape Canaveral, now targeted and still targeted for August 23rd. And Atlas V is to carry a NASA science mission into Earth orbit. A pair of spacecraft will be sent into a very high elliptical orbit over the planet to study Earth's radiation belts and how the sun affects those radiation belts and, of course, ultimately us. The mission is called the Radiation Belt Storm Probes Mission, the RBSP. Launch time is 4:08 in the morning, Eastern Daylight Time, again on August 23rd. In the meantime, while we won't be able to see it fly from our own backyards here on the Space Coast, it's very important to note, as we mentioned earlier, about our human spaceflight program is by no means dead. The next crew set to visit the International Space Station, scheduled for launch next Saturday from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, a Soyuz rocket, is to lift off at 10:40 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's Saturday night, again, 10:40 our time. Two cosmonauts and NASA astronaut Sunita Williams will be on board to join three others already in space, including former Melbourne High School science teacher Joe Acaba. Sunita will be making her second voyage to the space station and already holds the record for the longest single flight of an American female astronaut. And so she'll get to add to her her time in space as well. For more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com. Keyword Space Talk and look for the link to our launch forecast. You'll see all sorts of stuff, including my favorite, SpaceFlightNow.com. We're joined today, and very luckily so, by astronaut Tom Jones, a four-time shuttle flyer and I think four-time author as well, including his book Skywalking, a must-read on the top 10 list, in my view anyway. And Tom, again, welcome back to the show. We were talking about a bunch of current topics here, and the next thing I wanted to ask you about was China. We saw China go into space, do some remarkable things for them and really for anybody to pull off a mission like that. What are you thinking about China as a potential colleague, a competitor? Are we racing them back to the moon? What should we be thinking these days?
No, we're not racing the Chinese to the moon. They're doing steps in space that we took in the 1960s and early 1970s, so they're just getting their own national program going. I don't think the prospects for collaboration at our space station are very great either, and it's just because of the nature of the Chinese government. They're very secretive. Their human spaceflight program is run by their military, which is unwilling to release any of their design or safety engineering details to the West. So I don't think until that happens, until that whole society opens up and the military relaxes its grip on their program, that we're going to see any real chance of collaboration. Now, there is room for scientific partnerships. Chinese planetary probes could share their data with us, and we might have experiments that fly on their ships and vice versa, because those are sort of discrete operations from the human spaceflight program. We don't really have to know how their spacecraft functions for us to put an instrument on it and vice versa. And that may open up some avenues of mutual trust that could lead later on to human spaceflight collaboration. So just like with the Soviets back in the 70s, we should try to pursue scientific collaboration. But until their government policies change, I don't think we should be trying to bring them into the space station partnership.
Do you think our national leadership would change their tune if China suddenly were to send humans to the moon before we did and start stepping around on Sea of Tranquility?
Well, unless we have something to match that achievement with, then I do think we have a problem when that happens, because plainly that would mean that we've relinquished our lead in space. And you can brag all about what you did, brag all you want about what you did 50 years ago, but
right.
If you don't have that capability today or something beyond it, then you plainly are not a leader. So what I hope that NASA would be doing in the next 10 years, and the U.S. and its partners, is to establish humans in deep space around the moon, getting ready to go to the asteroids, perhaps at some kind of a Lagrange point outpost or a line shack. And that's plainly beyond the lunar distance. It plainly is a more complex operation than just repeating what we did with the Apollo program. So I wish the Chinese luck with their interest in space, but I don't see that we need to compete with them directly. I think we just need to pursue our own very valuable agenda in deep space, which I think is the key to that is to establish humans and robots to harvest the resources that are in space, generate wealth out there, and that helps pay for exploration of all sorts later on.
You talk about generating wealth, and of course that was a huge deal here, come up recently with the idea of mining asteroids for platinum.
Yes.
And whatever else, planetary resources, a very interesting initiative being looked at in the commercial world. What's your take on all of that? And I know you've had some experience in this area.
Well, I'm a science advisor for the Planetary Resources, Inc. Crowd, and they are very ambitiously trying to prospect and then mine asteroids in the next 10 years. I think the first product they'll go after is water, extracting water from the nearby asteroids. It's also on the lunar surface, as we know, and that can be a great propellant liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen for rocket fuel. Also, we might look at, as a byproduct, structural materials like nickel and iron for building things in space. And finally, at the end of the supply chain would be, the mining chain would be platinum group metals, which might be valuable enough to return to Earth. But that's far down the road after you get the resources that are most valuable in space.
Yeah, I always wonder about the precious minerals being, well, they're precious because we don't have a lot of them on Earth. We start flooding the market with other stuff from out of space. You kind of wonder what's going to happen to the value. But, of course, again, as you say, that's years in advance. We're getting close here to having to wrap up, Tom, and I just wanted to make sure we give you a chance to do the obligatory plugs here. You've got some great books out there and websites and things that you're doing. I want folks to know how they can get a hold of you and do some of this stuff if they're interested. Give us the obligatory plug.
Sure. The overall website is astronauttomjones.com.
How creative.
And when you go to astronauttomjones.com, you'll be able to see all of my books. And I've got, of course, my space memoir, Skywalking, where I try to put you in the cockpit and inside the spacesuit on the shuttle and at the space station. That's, I think, the best account of the human experience in space that's been written in the last 20 years or so. And I also think that people would enjoy Planetology, which is a great tour of the forces that shape the solar system. That's a great, beautiful book from National Geographic that I wrote with Ellen Stofan. And so I invite you to go to my website and check out all of those books. And, of course, I do a lot of public speaking, so I hope I'll see some of your listeners out on the speech circuit.
That'd be great. Tom Jones, thanks for another great hour with us on Space Talk and your great colleague to have in the space program. And we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
I really am grateful for the invitation.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk to you again, okay? All right, there goes Tom Jones. Hey, next Sunday we're going to continue to celebrate the 50th birthday of the Kennedy Space Center. Mark the annual anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch as well with the help of our current KSC director, Bob Cabana. In the meantime, don't forget our inbox at spacetalkingaol.com. Always open for you. One-stop shopping available at WMNBAM.com. Keyword Space Talk. That is it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today's program. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMNB presents a weekend edition of the best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey, and we will talk to you again real soon.